It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz.
I'm really intrigued by this story from when you were, I don't know, 4 or 5, and your dad told you about your name, about Nayad.
Yeah.
This is Diana Nayad, the long-distance swimmer.
My dad was a Greek-Egyptian. He spoke in a very thick accent. He was dramatic. He was theatrical. He was emotional. And the day I turned 5, he calls me in. We had a little den. And he said, come here, darling. Today, you are 5 years old, and I have been waiting for this day. Because today, darling, I am going to tell you the most significant thing I will ever tell you. Look in the dictionary. Naiad. In Greek mythology, the Naiad swam in the lake, river, fountain, and ocean to protect for the gods. All right? Now, look in my eyes. Next definition, Naiad. Girl or woman, champion, swimmer. Oh my God, darling, your destiny is written in black and white. So the word, I became a swimmer, and oddly enough, I'm a naiad. But that's not the word I heard. I heard the word champion. And I believe it. I believe it somewhere deep on a cellular level.
In 2013, Diana Nayad became the first person to swim from Cuba to Florida in open water. No shark cage, no breaks. And the thing about it was, she'd been trying to do that swim for more than 30 years. She tried and failed on 4 different occasions before she eventually made it. But the question is, why? Why did she persist? Well, our show today is all about people like Diana, champions. Ideas about their drive, their perseverance, and sometimes even the genetics that propel them to accomplish amazing feats of athletic achievement. Here's Diana Nayad on the TED stage.
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, I was turning 60, and I don't like being 60. And I started grappling with this existential angst of what little I had done with my life. Who would I become? How had I spent my valuable time? How could this have gone by like lightning? And I decided the remedy to all this malaise was going to be for me to chase an elevated dream. It was an old dream. It was from so many years ago, 3 decades ago. The only sort of world-class swim I had tried and failed at back in my 20s was going from Cuba to Florida. It was deep in my imagination. No one's ever done it without a shark cage. It's probably at my speed, at my age, for anybody's speed at anybody's age, going to take 60, maybe 70 hours of continuous swimming, never getting out on the boat. And I started to train. I hadn't swum for 31 years.
When most of us think about swimming, we think about like swimming in a bay or in a protected area of the ocean or in a swimming pool. But on this swim, you're not only out in the open water, you've got the Gulf Stream running right under you, which is like a giant river.
Oh, yes, it is. You know, there's this 100-plus-mile difference between the North Shore of Cuba and the South Shore of Florida, the Keys. And over most of that span of the 100 miles, the Gulf Stream shrinks and expands every day. Some days
Wow.
it's only 40 miles across. Some days it's 80 miles across.
Wow.
And this current has a countercurrent below it. And then what you got to picture, Guy, though, is it's not just the stream itself, but the eddies that are swirling. These are these counterclockwise eddies. Picture them like a vortex, because once you're in them, you're never out of them, ever. I stood on that shore and I looked across that to that long, long, faraway horizon, and I asked myself, do you have it? And I started swimming, and oh my God, it was glassy. And we knew it. All 50 people on the boat, we all knew this was it. This was our time. And I reminded myself a couple hours in, it's not going to feel this good all the way across. And I was thinking of the hypothermia and maybe some shoulder pain. But no, 2 hours in, wham! Never in my life. I knew there were Portuguese men of war, all kinds of moon jellies, all kinds of things, but the box jellyfish from the southern oceans is not supposed to be in these waters. And I was on fire. Excruciating pain. I feel like boiling hot oil I've been dipped in, and I'm yelling out, fire, fire, fire! And the next thing is paralysis. I feel it in the back, and then I feel it in the chest up here, and I can't breathe. And now I'm not swimming with a nice long stroke, I'm sort of crabbing it this way. Then come convulsions. And at 41 hours, this body couldn't make it. The devastation of those stings had taken the respiratory system down so that I couldn't make the progress I wanted. And the dream was crushed.
I mean, it's amazing because just a year later, you were back out there. You were trying the same swim again with the same jellyfish.
Well, you come back to say, what next? Will I wear pantyhose over the face? Will I wear this and this? And finally, this last time, I went to a prostheticist. He makes all kinds of masks for people who have had grenades blow up in their faces, who have had fires and are going to have skin grafts on their faces. He makes these beautiful, eerie silicone masks. And he made one for me. It took us a year to get the breathing right, to get the eyes right. But I wore that mask, and that was the last hurrah because I had surgeon's gloves. I had a tight, like, sprinter's kind of suit. And now, finally, I had the face, even the mouth covered, because those animals are genius at finding animal skin and protein at night. So I didn't go out there thinking, I'm just so tough, I'm going to get stung again. No, I went back saying, I'm going to go to the nth degree to find a way of swimming through them whereby they cannot sting me. It's the only way.
Just like, it's terrifying.
It's crazy stuff, isn't it?
It's the fifth time I stand on this shore, the Cuban shore, looking out at that distant horizon, believing again that I'm going to make it. The team is proud of our four attempts. Bonnie is my best friend and head handler. And as we're looking out, kind of a surreal moment before the first stroke, standing on the rocks at Marina Hemingway, Bonnie and I look at each other and we say, this year the mantra is, and I've been using it in training, find a way. Let's find our way to Florida. And we started, and for the next 53 hours, oh, it was an intense, unforgettable life experience. To be in the azure blue of the Gulf Stream. You're looking down miles and miles and miles to feel the majesty of this blue planet we live on. It's awe-inspiring. And then there are the crises. The vomiting starts, the seawater, you're not well, you're wearing a jellyfish mask for the ultimate protection. The hypothermia sets in. The water's 85 degrees, and yet you're losing weight and using calories. And as you come over toward the side of the boat, not allowed to touch it, not allowed to get out, but Bonnie and her team hands me nutrition and asks me what I'm doing, how am I all right? And coming into that third morning, Bonnie made a decision that I was suffering. I was hanging on by a thread. And she said, come here. And I came close to the boat and she said, look out there. And I saw a stream of white light along the horizon. And I said, it's going to be morning soon. She said, no. Those are the lights of Key West. It was 15 more hours. which for most swimmers would be a long time. And now the shore is coming. And there's just a little part of me that's sad. The epic journey is going to be over. But the point is, and the point was, that every day of our lives is epic. And I'll tell you, when I walked up onto that beach, staggered up onto that beach, it was a very real moment with that crowd, with my team. We did it. I didn't do it. We did it.
It's amazing if you think about it, this capacity that you have almost to be able to defy human capability.
You know what I think it really is? I think it's the fear not of dying. I'm quite accepting of that. But I think that my motivation in feeling that tremendous pressure that our time is so precious and so limited, that's what drives me. That's what drives me to dream big and not give in to fears.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you were more scared of not making it, right? Than you were of like...
Bingo.
Than you were of being killed.
Guy, bingo. I think it's interesting. I think when you talk to writers and scientists, you know, who are working on one particular project all their careers, and certainly athletes, I think the fear of failure is stronger, you know, more motivating than any other fear they've got. I know for me, you know, when I stand on that shore, which, as you know, I did 5 times, I wasn't saying, I hope I don't get eaten by a shark. Woo, I hope that box jellyfish doesn't come up and get me again. I hope maybe we get some luck with the currents. Maybe all that's buzzing around low, but more than anything, I don't want to fail. I want that destination. I want it.
Diana Nyad. On September 2nd, 2013, she walked ashore on Key West after swimming for 53 hours from Cuba. You can hear both of her TED Talks at ted.npr.org. I'm Guy Raz. In a moment, more ideas on what makes a champion. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And here we go then, into the Queen Victoria Memorial.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Our show today, the making of a champion.
And he'll turn right into the Mall and head towards gold.
So the winner of the 2012 Olympic marathon ran it in 2 hours, 8 minutes.
This is the Olympic champion, Stephen Kiprotich of Uganda, is the Olympic gold medalist. A brilliant, brilliant...
And had Stephen Kiprotich been running in the 1904 Olympic marathon, he'd have beat the actual winner, Thomas Hicks, by an hour and a half. A story told in a book by this guy.
David Epstein.
Who is full of facts like these.
I'm author of The Sports Gene.
David writes about sports science and medicine.
But I'm also an investigative reporter at ProPublica.
Which means it's basically his job to figure out how athletes do what they do. And he's particularly interested in why, over the past 100 years, they seem to have gotten so much better.
We definitely are better. Although, it sort of depends how you look at the question, because in some ways, if we're talking about raw human capabilities, we might not be as much better as we like to believe that we are.
Here's David on the TED stage.
The Olympic motto is Sitius Altius Fortius, faster, higher, stronger. And athletes have fulfilled that motto rapidly. In 1936, Jesse Owens held the world record in the 100 meters. Had Jesse Owens been racing last year in the world championships of the 100 meters, when Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt finished, Owens would have still had 14 feet to go. That's a lot in sprinter land. To give you a sense of how much it is, I want to share with you a demonstration conceived by sports scientist Ross Tucker. Now, picture the stadium at the World Championships of the 100 meters.
The Olympic men's 100 meters final. Thompson, Trinidad. Powell, Jamaica.
Thousands of fans waiting with bated breath to see Usain Bolt.
Bolt, Jamaica.
The fastest man in history.
Martina.
Flashbulbs popping as the nine fastest men in the world coil themselves into their blocks.
On your mark.
And I want you to pretend that Jesse Owens is in that race. Now close your eyes for a second and picture the race.
Set.
Oh, they're away, and Gatlin got away brilliantly, and he's ahead of the field at the moment.
An American sprinter jumps out to the front.
Bolt going very near. Comes Usain Bolt!
Usain Bolt starts to catch him. Usain Bolt passes him, and as the runners come to the finish, you'll hear a beep as each man crosses the line.
Usain Bolt storming through! He takes it again. Blake gets the silver. 9.6.
That first beep was Usain Bolt. That last beep was Jesse Owens. Listen to it again. When you think of it like that, it's not that big a difference, is it? And then consider that Usain Bolt started by propelling himself out of blocks, down a specially fabricated carpet, designed to allow him to travel as fast as humanly possible. Jesse Owens, on the other hand, ran on cinders. Rather than blocks, Jesse Owens had a gardening trowel that he had to use to dig holes in the cinders to start from. Biomechanical analysis of the speed of Owens' joints shows that had he been running on the same surface as Bolt, he wouldn't have been 14 feet behind. He would have been within one stride. Rather than the last beep, Owens would have been the second beep. Listen to it again. That's the difference track surface technology has made, and it's done it throughout the running world.
I mean, this is an incredible story. I mean, this would suggest that runners aren't really all that much faster today.
No, that's true. The differences are certainly wildly exaggerated. I mean, granted, Jesse Owens was blowing people away in his day, but there's no question about it.
And yeah, I mean, you hear those beeps and you cannot distinguish them. I mean, barely.
Yeah, right. It's like, brr. That's like pretty much it. And the difference between those guys, so what's, it's about 0.5% difference or 1% difference between a guy who's a living legend, and I don't think anybody else could even name one of those other beeps.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about. You're talking about 0.5% difference in performance.
It's incredible.
Yeah, that means like the difference between someone being a living legend and having an off-season job.
Still, technology isn't the only thing pushing athletes forward. While indeed we haven't evolved into a new species in a century, the gene pool within competitive sports most certainly has changed. In the early half of the 20th century, physical education instructors and coaches had the idea that the average body type was the best for all athletic endeavors. Medium height, medium weight, no matter the sport. And this showed in athletes' bodies. In the 1920s, the average elite high jumper and average elite shot putter were the same exact size. But as that idea started to fade away, as sports scientists and coaches realized that rather than the average body type, you want highly specialized bodies that fit into certain athletic niches. A form of artificial selection took place, a self-sorting for bodies that fit certain sports, and athletes' bodies became more different from one another. Today, rather than the same size as the average elite high jumper, the average elite shot putter is 2.5 inches taller and 130 pounds heavier. And this happened throughout the sports world. And at the same time, digital technology, first radio, then television and the internet, gave millions, or in some cases billions, of people a ticket to consume elite sports performance. The financial incentives and fame and glory afforded elite athletes skyrocketed, and it tipped toward the tiny upper echelon of performance. It accelerated the artificial selection for specialized bodies. In sports where height is prized, like basketball, the tall athletes got taller. In 1983, the National Basketball Association signed a groundbreaking agreement, making players partners in the league, entitled to shares of ticket revenues and television contracts. Suddenly, anybody who could be an NBA player wanted to be. And teams started scouring the globe for the bodies that could help them win championships. Almost overnight, the proportion of men in the NBA who are at least 7 feet tall doubled to 10%. Today, 1 in 10 men in the NBA are at least 7 feet tall. But a 7 foot tall man is incredibly rare in the general population. So rare that if you know an American man between the ages of 20 and 40 who's at least 7 feet tall, there's a 17% chance he's in the NBA right now. Still, even changing technology and the changing gene pool in sports don't account for all of the changes in performance. Athletes have a different mindset than they once did.
And one of those athletes is Pam Reed,
who's a legendary ultramarathoner, one of the greatest female ultra-endurance athletes of all time.
And back in 2002, Pam became the first ever female winner of the Badwater Ultramarathon, which is a 130-mile race in the middle of summer in Death Valley, which is also one of the hottest places on Earth.
Hi there. It is Pam Reed. You know what? It is 2 o'clock here. I'm in Salt Lake City.
Pam is 53.
I'm going to go for an hour run, and it's about 100 degrees. I'm doing some heat training right now.
And a few years ago, David tracked Pam down to find out what makes her different.
Pam has an incessant drive to be active. So this was my favorite interview because the day I interviewed her, she had just finished the national championships in Ironman triathlon here in New York the day before.
A 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike, 26.2-mile run. Discover it in a test of strength, resolve, endurance.
I got second, and it was a great race.
Okay, so the very next day, Pam was flying out of LaGuardia.
And her flight was delayed, and she gets so uncomfortable sitting still that she stashed her bags in a corner and was running laps around the parking structure while I was interviewing her. The day after the Ironman Triathlon National Championships.
You know, it's funny because I've done that in L.A., New York, Chicago, Phoenix, Tucson, you know, in the parking garages in all those airports. You know, I'll tell my husband, okay, I'll be back in an hour and a half, and I'll just go run around for an hour. I take my radio, and yeah, so it's so boring, you know, sitting there.
Now, scientists have tried for years to figure out how people like Pam do what they do. And as David was researching all of these elite athletes like Pam, he started to notice a pattern in the way they set goals.
Where it's not like I'm going to win, you know, the marathon at the Olympics. It's more like today in my workout from mile 3 to 4, I'm going to push hard. Like actionable goals where you have that Diana Nyad-sized feet off in the distance, but are really good at setting these sort of more proximate goals that actually tell you what to do today.
But there's something else that might set Pam apart. Now, normally, your brain is designed to limit what you can do with your body. At a certain point, if you're pushing your body beyond its limits, your brain will just shut your body down to make sure you don't die.
I mean, like, if you land at altitude, your brain will start holding back some of your physical resources before you've even tried to do anything.
Wow.
It will just sense, like, something's different in this atmosphere. I'm not going to let you use all of your resources. And part of pushing yourself farther is convincing your brain that, look, we're not going to die, or this is really important.
Well, yes, definitely. You have to just tell yourself, you feel like death. You do. He's right. You feel like death. And then for some reason, you come back to life. It's really bizarre. That's happened to me so many times.
There's no question that training is the ultimate biological exploration of your mind.
Yeah.
Beyond what any cutting-edge science can provide you at this point.
I mean, that's how you convince your brain that you're not going to die, right?
That's right. When you start training, and you know, exercise physiologists know this, before your muscles get bigger or you produce more red blood cells, you have an integration of your central nervous system that starts making activities smoother. Like if you've ever started training for running, you'll notice after a couple weeks, you start to feel smoother while running before you've even gotten in shape because your brain is sort of integrating the movements and adjusting to your new reality.
So I'm wondering, like, even in these elite athletes, right, who are wired and built, I guess, differently in so many ways, I mean, even for them, like, how important is winning, is victory?
It depends. It really depends. I think in many ways, for many athletes, it is. I mean, when I went to, you know, places like rural Kenya to visit the tribe that produces the Kalenjin, that produce all the great runners, like, they are running to live. Like, that's, you know, if they had a economic renaissance tomorrow, like, their running phenomenon would be done. So they will often drop out of races if they're not going to win because they're doing it purely to make a living. And in other cases, I don't think winning is everything for an athlete, but I think they do have to feel like they're improving. I think a lot of athletes get addicted to improvement. And if they feel like they're stagnating, not sort of beating themselves, then they get pretty disappointed pretty fast. At the same time, I think there's something natural to us about physical competition. And it's such a direct and sort of pure way to measure achievement that's very difficult to come by in other ways in life. And I think that can really motivate people to kind of tweak and tweak and tweak and try to find ways to get just a little bit better.
David Epstein. His book is called The Sports Gene. Check out his talk at TED.com. How would you describe yourself?
I don't even know how to describe myself anymore.
This is Amy Purdy.
I am a snowboarder, and I am a recent dancer on Dancing with the Stars.
And you did so well. I mean, you made it to the finals, to the end.
Yeah. I mean, it really was a journey.
Dancing the Cha-Cha-Cha. Amy Purdy and her partner, Derek Huff.
Our first dance was a cha-cha.
Beyond belief!
Salsa. Love it. So fun. You can do it anywhere.
I swear, I felt like I stopped breathing.
We did rumba, which is very sensual.
10!
The tango.
Dancing the Argentine tango.
Which I absolutely love it.
Totally spellbinding. I feel like I'm in a trance.
And you were like kind of the underdog.
For me, I was up against people who had their legs.
Amy was actually used to competing in the Paralympics as a snowboarder. But to be dancing on national television where her prosthetic legs had nothing to do with the competition was totally different.
I had to keep reminding myself as I went on throughout the weeks that this is pretty unbelievable.
Just a few weeks before she was on the show, Amy won a bronze medal at the Sochi Paralympics.
Amy Purdy has a bronze. She's smiling. She can take this easy.
Amy started snowboarding when she was 14. But 5 years later, the sport she loved suddenly became very different for her. What do you remember about getting sick?
I actually remember waking up feeling great that day. I remember the cold tile in my parents' house under my feet. But not thinking anything of it, of course. That's just a memory I had. But getting ready, going to work, and I felt exhausted. And I was thinking, maybe I'm coming down with the flu or something. But the next morning, my mom called to check on me, and I said, gosh, I feel like I'm dying. But I got to say, I'm known for being the dramatic one in the family. I still say that when I get a flu. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I'm dying. So I said, I feel like I'm dying. And she said, well, you're probably dehydrated. Make sure just to drink water and I'm sure you'll be fine. And we got off the phone and I fell into the deepest sleep that I have ever felt. All of a sudden, I opened my eyes. And as I was sitting up, I realized that something was really, really wrong. My heart was beating out of my chest. I was nauseous. I was sweating. I had chills. I scooted to the edge of the bed, and I put my feet on the floor, and I stood up, and I realized that I couldn't feel my feet. And I looked down at the floor, and I saw that my feet were purple. I saw that my hands were purple. And I saw that my nose, my chin, my cheeks were all purple as well. Right then, my cousin walked in. My mom had called her to come check on me, and she ended up rushing me to the hospital.
Amy picks up the rest of the story in her TED Talk.
I was in the hospital on life support with less than a 2% chance of living. It wasn't until days later, as I lay in a coma, that the doctors diagnosed me with bacterial meningitis. A vaccine-preventable blood infection. Over the course of 2.5 months, I lost my spleen, my kidneys, the hearing in my left ear, and both of my legs below the knee. When my parents wheeled me out of the hospital, I felt like I had been pieced back together like a patchwork doll. I was absolutely physically and emotionally broken. But I knew that in order to move forward, I had to let go of the old Amy and learn to embrace the new Amy. And I began to daydream. I daydreamed like I did as a little girl. And I imagined myself walking gracefully and snowboarding again. And I didn't just see myself carving down a mountain of powder. I could actually feel it. I could feel the wind against my face and the beat of my racing heart as if it were happening in that very moment. And that is when a new chapter in my life began.
Amy Purdy's story continues in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And today on the show, the making of a champion. And before the break, we were hearing the story of Amy Purdy. She was 19 when she lost both of her legs below the knee, and meningitis nearly killed her. But at the time, Amy was just grateful to be alive.
Because I knew how bad it was. I knew how close I was to dying. And I also knew that it could have been worse because I almost lost my hands as well. I almost lost my nose. So my nose turned black, my fingers turned black, my feet turned black. So, you know, preparing yourself to lose all these things and then only losing my legs was, for me, a blessing.
Amy was fitted with a pair of prosthetic legs. They were these bulky blocks of metal with pipes that were bolted together for the ankles, and the feet were made out of yellow rubber. But still,
I loved snowboarding, and it's kind of all I could think about as soon as I started to get kind of healthy enough to, you know, not be in survival mode. And this is still in the hospital, but all I would think about was snowboarding. And okay, how am I going to do this again? I never questioned, am I going to do this again? I just thought, how am I going to do this again?
4 months later, I was back up on a snowboard. Although things didn't go quite as expected, my knees and my ankles wouldn't bend. And at one point, I traumatized all the skiers on the chairlift when I fell. And my legs still attached to my snowboard went flying down the mountain. And I was on top of the mountain still. I was so shocked. I was just as shocked as everybody else. And I was so discouraged. But I knew that if I could find the right pair of feet, that I would be able to do this again. And this is when I learned that our borders and our obstacles can only do two things. One, stop us in our tracks, or two, force us to get creative. I did a year of research, still couldn't figure out what kind of legs to use, couldn't find any resources that could help me. So I decided to make a pair myself. My leg maker and I put random parts together, and we made a pair of feet that I could snowboard in. Rusted bolts, rubber, wood, and neon pink duct tape. And yes, I can change my toenail polish. It was these legs and the best 21st birthday gift I could ever receive, a new kidney from my dad, that allowed me to follow my dreams again. And just this past February, I won 2 back-to-back World Cup gold medals. Which made me the highest-ranked adaptive female snowboarder in the world. 11 years ago, when I lost my legs, I had no idea what to expect. But if you asked me today if I would ever want to change my situation, I would have to say no. Because my legs haven't disabled me. If anything, they've enabled me. They've forced me to believe in the possibilities. And that's why I believe that our imaginations can be used as tools for breaking through borders. Because in our minds, we can do anything, and we can be anything. It's believing in those dreams and facing our fears head on that allows us to live our lives beyond our limits. So the thought that I would like to challenge you with today is that maybe instead of looking at our challenges and our limitations as something negative or bad, we can begin to look at them as blessings. Magnificent gifts that can be used to ignite our imaginations and help us go further than we ever knew we could go. It's not about breaking down borders. It's about pushing off of them and seeing what amazing places they might bring us.
I know it's it might sound like a weird question, but I mean, you've won all of these medals and you're sort of like this elite athlete. And I don't know, in like a weird way, do you almost feel like you're a better snowboarder now? Like after everything that happened to you?
I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm better at snowboarding now. I am. I am, but it's still very challenging for me because my feet don't move the right way. I think I'm better because I work harder at it, and I'm passionate about it, and it becomes a challenge, and I thrive on challenge. The amount of work that I have put into my legs and snowboarding, the amount that I've gone into the development of my feet and my legs and the mechanics is crazy amounts of work. And the motivation just comes from, I guess it just comes from wanting to figure it out, like finding a way. And that's kind of how I go into everything. It's like I just don't like to hear that things are impossible.
When you compete, is a part of it to win, to be victorious?
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting because I don't necessarily find myself being really competitive with other people. I'm more very competitive with myself because as of right now, I'm the only international, like male and female competitive snowboarder with two prosthetic legs. So it's just doing the absolute best that I can because it's fulfilling. It's fulfilling to me to find out what those limitations are or to blow through the limitations that you thought you had. You know, we put so much on ourselves. We put so many limits on ourselves. It's unbelievable. I'm always like realizing, wow, so much of what I thought, you know, oh, my legs don't really do that. They don't do this. They don't do that. I end up doing it and realizing, wow, it was in my head that entire time.
What is it? Like, what's that thing that's inside of you that like drives you, that pushes you, that motivates you? I mean, is there something that you have that most of us don't?
I don't think so. I mean, if somebody would have told me, you know, when I was 18 years old that, okay, this is what your life is going to be like. You're going to have the world at your fingertips, and then bam, you're going to lose your legs, lose your kidneys, lose your spleen, lose the hearing in your left ear, you know, stuck in a wheelchair. You know, I would have said there's absolutely no way that I would be able to handle that. No way. I mean, I actually remember, and this is horrible, but this is just kind of what I think a teenager thinks about. I remember hearing about a kid who had lost his legs when I was in high school and thinking, oh, if I lost my legs, I would get myself in a wheelchair and I'd wheel myself off a cliff. Like, that was my thinking as a teenager, that would be the worst thing in the world, that I would have to, you know, take my own life or something. So then to be in this situation and handle it, it makes me feel like anybody would. You know, you don't know how strong you are until you're forced to find it, until you're forced to use it.
Amy Purdy, champion. Check out her full talk at ted.npr.org. What is it that drives people to want to master something, to want to achieve that?
The drive for mastery, I think, is very different from the drive for success. I think success, if you want that, it typically means, I think, that you want a kind of approval, you know? It's like society to sort of say that you're good. I think mastery is about really valuing your own opinion of what you're doing far more, really, than almost anyone else's. That is at the heart, I think, of mastery, just loving the process.
This is Sarah Lewis.
I'm a curator, an author, and I teach at Yale University School of Art.
Sarah writes about the differences between success and mastery and about the value of what she calls the near win.
And the near win has to do with that gap between where you are and where you want to go and the propulsion that comes from constantly trying to close it. And I think that's what the path of mastery looks like.
Here's Sarah Lewis on the TED stage.
I started to understand this when I went on one cold May day to watch a set of varsity archers, all women as fate would have it, at the northern tip of Manhattan at Columbia's Baker Athletic Complex. I wanted to see what's called archer's paradox, the idea that in order to actually hit your target, you have to aim at something slightly skew from it. I stood and watched as the coach drove up these women in this gray van and they exited with this kind of relaxed focus. They passed me and smiled, but they sized me up as they made their way to the turf and spoke to each other not with words, but with numbers, degrees, I thought, positions for how they might plan to hit their target. I stood behind one archer as her coach stood in between us to maybe assess who might need support and watched her, and I didn't understand how even one was going to hit the 10 ring. From the standard 75-yard distance, it looks as small as a matchstick tip held out at arm's length. And this is while holding 50 pounds of draw weight on each shot. She first hit a 7, I remember, then a 9, then two 10s, and the next arrow didn't even hit the target. And I saw that gave her more tenacity, and she went after it again and again. For 3 hours, this went on. At the end of the practice, one of the archers was so taxed that she laid out on the ground just starfished. It's so rare in American culture, there's so little that's vocational about it anymore, to look at what doggedness looks like with this level of exactitude. What it means to align your body posture for 3 hours in order to hit a target. Pursuing a kind of excellence in obscurity. But I stayed because I realized I was witnessing what's so rare to glimpse, that difference between success and mastery. So success is hitting that 10 ring, but mastery is knowing that it means nothing if you can't do it again and again.
Is there something that those archers have that, like, that we don't?
You know, what intrigued me about those archers is that they seemed like proxies for us. So I understood this idea about the gift of the near win really by watching them, by watching that process, and seeing in that instant how people would shift. And that's, for me, why it became a kind of metaphor for life. How is it that you're going to achieve your goal in spite of the many things that could knock you off, you know?
I mean, you think about somebody like Diana Nyad, who we just heard from in the show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she had 4 near wins before she made it.
Yeah,
and exactly. And you hear that. You hear those stories, and you think those were just as important as her ultimate win.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, her journey reminds me of really the validity of Winston Churchill's quote when he said, success is the ability to go from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. But the question is, what does it take to stay encouraged? Diana Nyad, though, for me, is like a contemporary story because there's someone who sort of came before her, Florence Mae Chadwick, another channel swimmer. In 1952, she wanted to swim the Catalina Channel. And she found herself in this position of coming close to her goal, but she just couldn't continue. She couldn't make it across the channel. So she decided to get into the boat, and she was in the middle of a really foggy period in the Catalina Channel. And so as she found her breath again and was in this boat, and the fog lifted. She noticed that she was just a mile from her goal, from the shore. And what she said was so instructive, you know. She said, "I think if I had seen the shore, I could have made it." And so she decided 2 months later to swim the Catalina Channel again. And she not only completed it, but she bested the men's record for doing so in 1952.
Wow.
And I love that. I think she described what allowed Diana Nye to keep going. She kept the shoreline in her mind's eye the whole time. Success motivates us, but a near win can propel us in an ongoing quest. One of the most vivid examples of this comes when we look at the difference between Olympic silver medalist and bronze medalist after competition. Thomas Gilovich and his team from Cornell studied this difference and found that the frustration silver medalists feel compared to bronze, who are typically a bit more happy to have just not received fourth place and not medaled at all, gives silver medalist a focus on follow-up competition. And this is what a near win does. It gets us to focus on what right now we plan to do to address that mountain in our sights. It's Jackie Joyner-Kersee who in 1984 missed taking the gold in the heptathlon by 1/3 of a second. In 1988, she won the gold in the heptathlon and set a record of 7,291 points, a score that no athlete has come very close to since. We thrive not when we've done it all, but when we still have more to do. We know that we thrive when we stay at our own leading edge, and it's why the deliberate incomplete is inbuilt into creation myths. In Navajo culture, some craftsmen and women would deliberately put an imperfection in textiles and ceramics. It's what's called a spirit line, and deliberate flaw in the pattern to give the weaver or maker a way out, but also a reason to continue making work. Masters are not experts because they take a subject to its conceptual end. They're masters because they realize that there isn't one. We build out of the unfinished idea, even if that idea is our former self. This is the dynamic of mastery. Coming close to what you thought you wanted can help you attain more than you ever dreamed you could. Even if we created utopias, I believe we would still have the incomplete. Completion is a goal, but we hope it is never the end. Thank you.
Sarah Lewis, her book about mastery is called The Rise. Check out her full talk at ted.npr.org.
A winner take all.
Winner take all.
Winner take all.
Winner take all.
I'm playing a game called a winner take all. Your kiss is the
best. Hey, thanks for listening to our show on the making of a champion this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, check out ted.npr.org. You can also find many, many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download this show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Daniel Shukin, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Eric Newsom. Our intern is Alyssa Eads. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And let the chips begin to fall.